Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Thanks very much for coming, and welcome back to another Word in Your Ear podcast, which Dave and I started when we were still running Word magazine. And one of its star contributors was our guest this evening, who's written books about Johnny Cash and Elvis Costello and Kate Bush and George Harrison, and has also broken some sort of record. I know some of you may have strolled over from King's Cross, but he has come all the way from Scotland to be here tonight. So please give him a thunderous kind of round of applause, the great Graham Thompson. Now, I don't know if there's any connection between Kate Bush and... is there any similar characteristics? Kate Bush, Johnny Cash? I don't know. This is your seventh book, I think.
It is. Lyman. Number seven. Lucky
What was it about him that made you want to write a book as opposed to just a piece in a magazine?
I think it was that kind of that image, actually. The cartoon idea of Phil Lynott as this kind of quintessential rock star, platonic rock star with the leather trousers and the gypsy earring.
The trews.
And I always think, if you start from that position where you maybe feel there isn't a huge amount of substance, and then you start listening to the music, and there's a kind of dissonance, I think, between the way he presented himself and his voice, I think, which was a kind of melancholy and quite a vulnerable, soulful voice, and then the lyrics as well.
There's a brilliant bit of the book where you describe his voice as a crooner, but he's been seduced by high wattage and
that's
amplification.
Right. I think that's true. Probably to his detriment, ultimately.
Yeah.
So you start to... tune into the music, and you feel there's maybe something more going on there beyond or behind the cartoon and behind the one-dimensional rocker image. And that I find that quite interesting. It's probably the least music-led book I've written. I think it was more, I was more interested in his personality.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Before going any further, can I just ask one question? Mm. How do you have an authorized biography of a...
That's a good... Someone else asked
late
that question.
Person.
It's the estate. So in this case, it's his wife, Caroline. Leslie Crowther's daughter. Some of you may know that.
Right.
And his children. He had two daughters.
But presumably she gave permission to all her friends to say, this guy's all right, you can talk.
Were you approached by them to write it?
I approached her, because she has never talked about him at all before. So, and we felt that the only way really to do a book about Philip Lynott, there's been a few in the past, would be to do it that way and to try and tell the story as it hasn't been told before. So I wrote to her and kind of explained who I was and what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it. And she got back to me, and we took it from there. She didn't intervene at all. She collaborated. She read the final manuscript. A lot of it was quite difficult for her, as you can probably imagine, because it's a sad story ultimately, and it doesn't end well, as I'm sure
as
most
we
of you
shall
know.
Discover. Yeah. if we don't already know.
So she was very good. There was no kind of vetoing or whitewashing, and that's how it's authorized. Yeah.
But we wanted to start. Well, this is an obvious place to start because, I mean, he was an English-born black illegitimate Irish Guyanese. If that's correct. Those are his parents. His father, Cecil Parish, known as the Duke, who he virtually never met. We'll
come
to that story later. And that's his mother, Philomena, who had had three children by three different men by the age of 21. So quite a fairly chaotic life, I think.
Yeah, it's not your archetypal upbringing.
No.
And the Irish Afro-Guyanese, I don't
know. So did he feel he was an outsider, and he's quite defensive, isn't he?
He was. And those first, he spent the first 7 years of his life living in England. It wasn't until he was seven that he went to live with his grandmother in Crumlin, Ireland. So he was moving around, a very itinerant and hard-scrabble kind of upbringing in those first 7 years in the northern towns of England and cities. Two younger children who were put up for adoption, and it's still open to dispute how much he knew about those kids, and so it was very difficult, and he never really talked about him. And I write in the book, the old Jesuit saying, "Give me the child for the first 7 years, and I'll show you the man." And I think the difficulties he had in that time, and he never really talked about them at all, were quite significant for the way he viewed himself and the way he lived the rest of his life.
But he grew up in sort of boarding houses and halfway hostels and utter chaos. Really.
And possibly worse. I mean, some of these people are still alive, so there is a limit to what, still what we can say about it. But it was a pretty hairy environment, certainly.
Well, I thought we'd just mention, because it fascinates me, being English, and I don't know that much about it, but the show band circuit of Ireland. So Rory Gallagher is actually in the picture there, who's actually a year older than Phil. He's at the front there. But, I mean, it's one of the things that he achieved is that he was kind of one of the first kind of homegrown Irish rock stars to break out of this circuit, because they all grew up. Anyone who was a musician went into a band to play covers for the top 40, didn't they?
That's right.
How that worked, the show band.
Van Morrison was another one. Well, they were generally seven-piece bands, so there would be your traditional drums, bass, guitar, singer, usually a three-piece horn section. And they had the ballroom circuit of Ireland tied up. So these were the big venues, the more professional venues. And they would, as Mark said, they would just play the songs of the day, the top 40. They would learn them, they would play them without any great deal of expression. Or there's a great quote about Eric Bell being in one of these bands, who was the guitar player in Thin Lizzy, and he tried to do some kind of fancy solo. And one of his bandmates said, "Knock it off, Ravi Shankar."
Ravi Shankar, that's brilliant. Docked £5.
So that was the kind of artistic level of expression that people were interested in. So, and they had the whole of the show band circuit basically tied up. So what you had on the level two or three rungs below that were these little beat groups that started coming out that wanted to do something a bit more interesting. And that was for Philip. I mean, there's a question of whether he ever would have been allowed in a show band because he was black. And I'm not sure. Yeah, they possibly wouldn't have had him in there. But trying to escape from that was very difficult. And even when Thin Lizzy, when they left Ireland for London in 1970, they had just got to the level where they could play the proper venues. You know, they were playing tennis clubs and church halls and all that kind of stuff.
When they were met with signs on all the boarding houses saying, "No blacks, no Irish."
That's right.
It's astonishing,
yeah.
Isn't it? You think about it now. This is, this is his first group when he was, I think, 14. That's him on the far right. The Black Eagles, is that right? And they were kind of covers. They did four nights a week.
Well, they were called the Eagles before Philip arrived. They were the Black Eagles.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was it. Yeah. And what would they have played? What sort of material would they have played? What songs?
They would play Beatles. They would play "You Really Got Me" by the Kinks. They would play maybe a bit of soul music, Otis Redding. But yeah, the beat groups of that day. And there was, I mean, it wasn't a hugely expressive catalogue or repertoire. It was still the pop hits, really, but with a little bit of an edge and a bit of. He was always into soul music. So it would be those sort of pop standards, but done with a little bit more aggression and a bit more energy.
And who would they be playing in front of? Other teenagers?
Or? Yeah, it would be church halls, tennis halls, hops, you know, or afternoon clubs on a Saturday, the Flamingo Club on Grafton Street and places like that.
Was he already starting to identify himself as a bit of a ladies' man on stage, even at that stage?
Yeah, but he was actually very shy on stage when he started. He was quite an introverted person. And I think because there's great stories about him arriving in Dublin, and it was like someone had dropped out of thin. There was precisely four black people in the whole of Dublin, 600,000 people.
And they knew each other.
So
together for safety.
Someone described him in the book as being like a peacock. You know, it was just automatically an exotic creature. And the kids at school would line up to touch his hair, you know, because he was this exotic guy. So I think he was used to the attention from a very early age because he would, you know, he'd literally stop traffic walking down the street. So coming from that, I think he did get used quite quickly to a bit of female attention.
Right.
This was Skid Row, the group that he joined when he was 18, and there he is on the right. And and you say in the book that, as you were saying, he was very, very shy and he didn't have much self-confidence and not much idea of stagecraft. And, I mean, how did that develop? I mean,
very slowly, actually. Yeah. I mean, even in the early stages of Thin Lizzy, when they were a trio, I don't know if you know, but Thin Lizzy were really effectively two bands. The first few years they were a trio, and then the classic lineup with Scott Gorham and Brian Robertson, which we mostly recognise as the classic Thin Lizzy with Boys Are Back in Time. But in the early part, he was playing bass and singing, which, Mark, as you know, can be quite tricky.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, nice of you to put
to
me
do
in
at that level.
Fellow professionals.
Well, also being the ladies' man as well.
All these things.
You can identify with us.
Bearing the pressure of all that attention. Go on, sorry.
So, yeah, he was kind of noodling away on an instrument he hadn't learned very, very well anyway. And he was very shy. People talk about him being, you know, he was very tall and gangly and kind of hunched over and not necessarily looking people in the eye.
There's a great headline in the paper, in the Evening Herald, which is "Group Perform Blasphemous Song at Local Dance." What was that again? They had some projection. They were projecting images of the Pope or something.
Well, this was them under the influence of the Grateful Dead and the Velvet Underground, which was trickling over very slowly to Dublin, and they were playing, you know, liquid lights and all this stuff. And they had this idea of doing a back projection when they were playing. I think it was Sky Pilot. I think was the song they were playing. Yeah. And so they were mixing footage of the JFK assassination with the Pope's visit. Or the Pope's Easter address to the Vatican, and this caused absolute outrage.
You can imagine how it might, you know. Kennedy, you know.
Yeah, but they would do all these funny things. They would do little skits on stage where they would sort of mock amputations, and they would do scenes from the Defiant Ones where Philip was Sidney Poitier and Anthony Curtis. So yeah, there was a kind of theatrical element to the band at that point. So, and you can imagine in a very small scene like Dublin where there wasn't an awful lot of that going on, they made an impact really quickly.
So who were the other bands around at the time in Dublin when they were kicking around?
There was a band called The Method, which Gary Moore was in for a while. There was a band called Elmer Fudd.
Shame to say I've heard of them.
Have you?
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. It's a cartoon character, Elmer Fudd.
Not him, but the
What sort of music did they... But what kind of stuff?
It was kind of getting towards heavy-ish rock, but there was a lot of soul influence at that time in Dublin as well. Yeah. Sort of 67, 68. But and the band that became Heir Apparent, which were
Ernie Graham and all that.
Yeah. But they all had to leave, of course. I mean, there was no real.
There was nowhere to go.
No, there was nowhere to go in Dublin.
Yeah.
This is him again around that time on his 18. I like this picture very much. In fact, I actually had one of those wristbands.
Snakeskin wristband with a leather thong.
Beautiful.
And they
were a popular item.
Oh, they were a very popular item, yeah. And I put that in there because, you know, he was going through the stage, as everyone was, of thinking of Bob Dylan not as a songwriter, but as a poet.
Yeah.
He wasn't a lyricist, he was a poet. What he wrote was poetry that was set to music, which was somehow putting song lyrics and the art of craft of songwriting on a completely different level. And he was reading, you know, James Joyce and Flannery O'Brien and Yeats and just soaking up a huge diversity of kind of Irish culture, wasn't he?
He was. I think it's a really interesting period, just prior to Thin Lizzy forming, where he's hanging out with all these different artistic groups in Dublin, and there's the sort of bohemian Dr. Strangely Strange, who I don't know if anyone remembers, are the sort of, I don't know, very the Irish so. Incredible String Band.
Of the Incredible String Band came and stayed in his...
That's
in
right, Robin Williamson came and stayed and meditated in their house, and everyone was just blown away by this. So he was, you know, he was writing poetry, he was the folk artist as well around at that time. I sense someone who was trying to find direction, really. You know, it was always about, where does this lead? Where can I get out and make a mark? And he did have a very kind of literary side. You can hear that in the lyrics, less and less so, perhaps, as it goes on. But he did aspire, certainly, to poetry.
He took a book around with him and wrote stuff down all the time.
He had a sort of gypsy bag with a book, and he was always making observations and... researching the book, the amount that he revised his lyrics and was constantly working on his words, I was quite surprised by, actually.
Yeah.
There was always different versions and always moving around different verses. And you know, the first song he wrote was very much, I think it was called The Death of a Fawn. You know, it was this very, very fey.
Very fey.
It's not the rocker, you know, it's not Jailbreak.
He didn't talk about that in interviews.
No, he didn't, no.
Death of a Fawn. So that's the influence of the meditating Robin Williams of the Incredible
exactly
String
what
Band,
it is.
Probably.
Yeah. They were slightly older. These are graduates at Trinity College. You know, these are quite, for a boy from Crumlin, he's a very working class guy. He was suddenly in quite heady academic atmosphere.
And describe the orphanage, because that was a sort of commune, really, that he lived in when he was
this
time.
This big house called The Orphanage, which was down near the canal in Dublin, and that was Dr. Strangely Strange kind of ad hoc headquarters, where people could just come and doss and stay the night and have parties and smoke dope and write songs called The Death of a Fawn. he was the sort of junior member of this band, and I think it was very influential for him. I think, you know, he released two books of poetry or lyrics, we could call them, you know, depending on your dispensation. And there was clearly a part of him who really wanted to be accepted, I think, by that crowd and that kind of literary level. And that seemed to drive him for a while. And I think when his lyrics maybe started to tail off, that was one of the disappointments in his life, that he wasn't maybe recognised in that
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is a shot from about 2 years later. I love this. He's actually modelling, wasn't he?
He is modelling.
It's a modelling shot for a fashion magazine in Ireland, and he would have been 21. And obviously, huge influence of Jimi Hendrix now, fairly obvious, in the way he dressed and also in his music. But there was a bit in the book where you described the...
how he was always interested in the Lothario, the gunslinger, the gypsy, the cowboy, the vagabond, you know, all those, the Johnnies and the Randolphs and the Rockies, those characters who appear in his lyrics. Now, where did all that come from? That came from the movies, was it, and books, and where did he get that?
I would
say
mainly movies, but also I think the lack of a father. I think you can always, you can see him trying to fill that role, and also fill it for himself. I think something to aspire to for himself, because he didn't have that role model. So they're coming down off the movie screens and you know, littered with cinemas in Dublin at that time, so they were always going to the movies. And I think, yeah, it was trying to find some kind of place in the world, I suppose, in a sense of his own masculinity, because he, as you said, his dad was, his nickname was the Duke, and he had this reputation, I think, as a real ladies man and a sharp dresser. And that picture you showed, you know, he's got the small moustache that Philip, you know, later cultivated himself. So I think it's really about trying to to find his place and to find his father, but also find his own sense of manhood as well.
His phenomenal appetite. You say that he was either working, having sex, or smoking, or talking, or asleep, really.
That was pretty much it. That was the diary for most of us.
Got up, yes.
But what was amazing is that he did get up. You know, he did get up every morning. He was up at 8 o'clock in the morning. Everyone said how together he was for such a long time. Yeah. You know, he would work very hard, he would play very hard, he'd get up in the morning at 8 o'clock, and he'd be ready to do it again, looking immaculate. So he did have an amazing chemistry, I think, and capacity for life. Yeah,
this is making the first Thin Lizzy album. That'd be Eric on the right, and that's Brian Downey, the drummer, in the middle, and that's him. And I'm not sure if I can recognise the people at the back. Is it some of the record company?
It's sort of various producers and roadies.
Oh, that's right. And what was he trying to, you know, what
the local
sophisticates. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Stylish. It's another fashion shoot.
That's romantics.
That's Ted Carroll. I don't know if you know
Ted Carroll. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course it is. But what was he able to do forming Thin Lizzy as he had there that he hadn't been able to do before? What did it allow him to do?
I think it gave a focus to all the different energies that he'd had. You know, he was toying around with folk music and poetry and soul music in Skid Row a lot of the time, and it just, I think Eric Bell, who was an amazing guitar player, a great blues guitar player, he kind of sharpened that idea of where the music could go. Brian Downey is a great drummer. They gave him a very solid bedrock. And also, as a three-piece, you know, one of his conditions of being in the band was that he played bass and that they played his songs. So it was the first time where they actually started to write and perform his own songs, which I think was always what he wanted to do. So, but it took them a while. I mean, the first three or four records, Thin Lizzy, are They're patchy, you know. There's still a band, I think, trying to find its identity.
Yeah. And they were signed to Decca, weren't they?
Yeah.
Which is rarely the ticket to success in the late 60s, you know.
Yeah. And they'd done that, you know, and it took...
On the DRAM label, are they possibly?
No, it wasn't the DRAM label.
Not even DRAM.
Not even DRAM.
Wow.
No.
Sorry, I just have to interrupt you, because we were at a literary festival in Larne, Wales, about 2 weeks ago, and there was a moment where Tracy Thorne, we were sitting in a group of people, Stuart McConey and Tracy Thorne, and Tracy Thorne got up and said, I can't believe this. David Hepworth and Mark Allen talking about whether or not the Rolling Stones' early records were on the DRAM label. Said, I'm off to bed. Basically said, we're doing it again. We'll have to stop this. Well, sorry about that.
It wasn't the Rolling Stones. It was somebody else.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It was Decca, anyway. It wasn't DRAM.
It was Decca. That's that sorted out. Yep. Good. Yeah, please stay, the audience. Absolutely. Don't leave.
But they also toured, I think, at this stage with Slade, was it? And learned a huge amount from watching Noddy Holder and everybody in the Wings. Is that
That's right?
Right.
In fact, the classic mirrored scratch plate that Phil Lynott had on his bass, was inspired by Noddy's hat.
Oh, really? That's
mirrored
right.
Because
it reflected shafts of light across the room.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that was their first proper tour. They were playing 4,000 or 5,000 seat of theatres. You know, and Slade were 72. They were the biggest band since the Beatles, probably, weren't they? You know, pop hits, but they were a really energetic and loud and powerful and raucous band. And the first night they toured with them, they were the opening act, and they were kind of noodling away, you know, in the corner playing their slow blues. I think it was called slow blues, actually. And they were off within two songs. And the manager, Chas Chandler, was the manager of Slade at that time, and I think gave them a complete dressing down. And they returned two nights later with a much sharper set. And he started to look at how he could... And this is the start of him, I suppose, being that performer and showman. He started looking at how he could move on stage and how he could make that connection with the audience. Because before, I think it was very much heads down and noodle away. Which is astonishing, thinking about what he became. But he was a very introverted performer. So that was the start of that process.
Did he have to go through this
this kind of wall where he stopped looking into space and started looking at the audience, kind of making contact.
Absolutely. In fact, Ted Carroll used to give him literally give him lines to say to the audience because he didn't have anything to say.
What kind of things?
Just like, hi, how are you?
He had to be given that on a piece of paper.
It was like, hi, how are you?
To be fair, there's loads of bands that still don't do stuff like that. Actually.
Yeah.
Doesn't occur to them.
So that very much was. And I think, and so he started thinking about it. You know, I think it was very much a kind of clinical process with him. He would go in front of the mirror and he would learn how to pose with the bass. And the mirrored scratch plate started out as a little canary. You know the little canary mirrors you get in Budgie?
Yeah.
He hung that on the end, the machine head of his bass. Obviously didn't work. So he refined that.
A really pissed off canary.
And the canary wasn't there, right? So that was the start of him. I think he thought a huge amount about the band. It was very much an all-consuming thing for him, so, you know, how it all worked and fitted together.
This is the lineup that had when Whiskey in the Jar was a hit, which was sort of their first hit that got them attention, but also a kind of millstone around the neck in that they started to detest this song, didn't they?
They hated it even before they put it out.
That's right.
Yeah, because it was, I mean, Whiskey in the Jar is an old Irish folk song, of course, and it was very much what they were trying to get away from, was that sense of, as he, you know, they called it the paddies coming off the boat and that Irishness. And they always felt, and Philip always felt, I think, that as an Irish band in London, they were very much looked down upon and sneered at because their success in Ireland didn't really mean anything over here. And that song was knocked up at a rehearsal, and just it was a classic record company thing of saying, that's not the B-side.
Did it by mistake kind of thing.
Pretty much, yeah.
And then the next thing they knew...
Was, you know, people saying, is your next single going to be The Long Way to Tipperary?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. Yeah, that was suggested.
That was suggested, was suggested.
Was it?
And he's, you know, going, oh, my God. So everything they'd kind of worked
actually,
towards.
In the long run, it wasn't a bad thing because it gave some idea of the kind of Celtic flavour of the group's music and that, which really worked in particular.
But also what they found out was people would come... They were playing bigger venues because they'd had a hit, and people would come, you know, surge to the front for Whiskey in the Jar and then immediately scuttle back to the back of the venue.
Do a little jig.
Yeah, when slow blues or something. So it made him have to think about how this was going to work.
But there's a really fascinating bit in the book where this is a hit and so there's lots of press interest. He starts doing interviews and they start asking him about his parentage.
That's right.
And he starts talking about his father and it reveals that he hasn't seen his father for years. And it's around this time, I think, that his father... He got in touch with him, didn't he? And he was running a stall in Portobello Road or something?
Shepherd's Bush Market. Strangely, a hit comes and a father comes shortly afterwards.
Happened to John Lennon, though. Yeah,
Freddie Lennon suddenly appeared, knocking on the door.
If you want to find your long-lost father, have a number one hit record. He'll find his way from right across the world.
Yeah. But that's what happened. He did an interview where in Titbits magazine, which was a... classic.
That's the place to find your long lost father.
That's what your father would be reading.
Your long lost father is reading that.
But amazingly, he still didn't know anything about him. You know, he was talking about a guy called the Duke, who was maybe Brazilian. That's as much as he knew.
Oh right.
And actually, there were stories of him wandering up and down Portobello Road, going into. He thought he was a barber, going into barber shops, going, "Do you know the Duke?" And people going, "You know."
Why didn't he know very much? Is that because his mother didn't know very much, or because his mother didn't tell him very much?
I think the latter, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and not much filtered down, I think, information. The stories of him writing letters to his dad that his mother was supposed to pass on, and they weren't passed on when he was younger, and things like that. So it's quite a complicated background, but yes.
But they did meet, didn't they?
They met in the mid-70s.
And what happened?
Well, it kind of fell flat on its face very quickly.
Didn't he take a member of Thin Lizzy with him also? I can't remember.
Well, Scott Gorham was there at the meeting, and this guy, as he put it, this guy walked in looking like Superfly with a, you know, a white Panama hat and a white suit and white shoes. The Duke, you know, here he was. Yeah. But, you know, he had a wife and he had kids. And I think very rapidly the expectations that Phil might have had about this guy evaporated. And he was just a fairly normal guy running a hat stand in Shepherd's Bush Market, which is still there.
Phil himself had a child. I've forgotten this completely. He had a child. It was just like, almost like that, something out of the movie Philomena. His girlfriend got pregnant when she was 17 or something.
That's right.
Was sent away to the nuns.
To the
nuns.
Isn't
that right?
Yeah.
Until she'd had the child.
Yeah, this was in the late 60s, so he was only 18.
18.
Yeah.
And that had a very profound effect on him, though, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it did have a very profound... And he told one person about it. There's certain songs you listen to, Little Girl in Bloom and things. Where
who
you
did can, he tell?
He told his friend Jim Fitzpatrick, who was an artist, because when he was doing his book of lyrics, this song, Little Girl in Bloom, which is about a young girl getting pregnant, and Jim was doing the illustrations and wanted to know what idea of what yeah. she looked like, and he actually told him that it was a real girl and described her to him. But yes, yeah, so it's a son he never met.
What a complicated life.
It's yeah, and you know,
as if it wasn't complicated.
The old sins of the father thing.
Absolutely, you know, it's completely. This is the what I think you'd call the classic lineup. A picture obviously stolen by me from the internet because you've got the Getty Images copyright there.
Finn Costello.
If Finn Where Costello, the photographer, is here, I'll give you a fiver later. I'm sorry.
We
about
know
that.
Finn.
Well, we know him, anyway. We know him. But that is what I think you call the classic lineup. So this is
it's a classic trousers, isn't it?
It's a classic trousers. Pose as well, isn't it?
Classic yes. pose, yeah. And it's Brian Robertson and Scott Gorham on the right. So what was it that finally got it to take off? Was it him hitting the kind of, you know, the signature twin guitar sound? Or what was it, do you think, that made the difference? Or Boys Are Back in Town, or just
partly just that song, I yeah. think. But yeah, I think, I mean, it was the sixth album they'd done. They were on their second lineup. I think they were probably going to get turfed off their label if it hadn't happened then. And his writing had changed. I think that sort of more Springsteen-style, kind of street opera, character-driven narrative, which was much leaner than his early stuff.
So what year are we talking about here?
That, well, 76 would have been Boys Are Back in Town, Jailbreak. Yep. That's kind of when it happened.
Right.
76, 77, 78, I suppose, was the peak of that.
And they were just an unbelievable bunch of hellraisers. I just couldn't. It just wouldn't happen now, I don't think. You know, but just the people wouldn't be allowed to carry on like that. They just Brian Robertson in the middle there, just at one point, in a barroom brawl, broke his hand and just had to be thrown out of the group for 6 months because he couldn't physically play anymore.
He couldn't play because he was stopped.
It's just unbelievable.
Well, he claims he was stopping Frankie Miller being glassed by a member of Gonzalez.
don't say anything about Frankie Miller.
I've already been sued by Frankie Miller once in my life.
You went to court once over Frankie Miller.
Yeah. So that was his defence. It was catastrophic. Things keep going terribly wrong. He got hepatitis on an American tour, so they had to come home. Just as Boys Are Back in Town was breaking, they had to come back. Then when they were ready to go back again, Brian Robertson got his hand slashed in a barroom fight.
And later on, I think Gary Moore just walked out.
Gary Moore just left.
Midgeur of Ultravox, the short-haired, mustachioed Midgeur, was amazing. flown in astonishingly,
in
to play
his canary jumpsuit. Yeah,
that's right.
to play guitar and then keyboards, and then then Snowy White came in, who's a very kind of laid-back blues guitar player. And
in fact, in this book, everybody passes through the pages of this book. Don't
yeah, pretty
briefly.
Much. Yeah,
you know, every reprobate. You
Johnny
know,
Thunders and Sid Vicious.
Oh, I'd forgotten about him. Yeah. Oh, he was he there is. For a week. You know, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. It did start to.
He was certainly a clubbable person, wasn't he?
Literally,
he kind of
literally, literally.
Yeah, he attracted.
But I think there's something quite kind of heroic about the way that he grabbed that. I mean, I think in the 70s you could. You could be a rock star without having to say apologise for it, or be ironic about
completely.
It.
You see, I think this is a serious point. I don't think you can be a rock star in the age of social media.
Yeah.
Because you would spend every day apologising.
Just saying sorry. And he was.
Well, you really would. Yeah. Pretend the whole thing was ironic, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
Because this wasn't ironic.
This was what he wanted. This is all he wanted to do.
He got up in the morning and he lived this life. Although, actually, interestingly, you say in the book that he was incredibly ruthlessly professional, which I never really imagined. That, you know, if somebody dropped a note in the fourth bar, there would be some massive bust-up afterwards.
There would be.
They were drilled they called, and
they
routine
called him,
yeah, to get
Sergeant
right.
Rock, they called him.
Oh, really?
The bandmates. Yeah, Sergeant Rock. Because he would literally line them up and down and tell them
good.
Off. Yeah.
And also that he was so charming. You know, the second best worker of a room in the world, you said. Second only to Freddie Mercury.
To Freddie Mercury,
so he went out and he would go and obviously into the secretarial pools of other reasons, I'm sure, but would go into the record companies and meet all the girls personally and thank them for their part in helping extend the marketing of his records, you know.
Yes, in any way they wish to, yeah.
Yeah.
You know that famous line that he used to use at the time?
Oh, the little Irish,
There may be people in this room who've never heard that line.
The line about, well, what he used to say on stage, I'm sure you all know it, it's on Live and Dangerous, I think, but he would say, has any of the girls here got any Irish in them? And there would be a...
pause.
They say, would any of the girls like a little bit more Irish in them?
There it is.
And that was
So what did he say every
night?
That
was his level of chat-up line.
And that was written for him by Ted Carroll.
We thought it was hilarious in 1976.
Right.
Huh? We thought it was hilarious back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
And I just want to know, did he say it every night?
I think they did become very rote, actually, the show. Yeah, there was. That Live and Dangerous set, which was mostly recorded in 1976, they were still playing in 1983.
The other interesting thing about this lineup, you can't see him very much here, is that Scott Gorham was the other big heartthrob in that group, wasn't he? So he was not afraid of having a bit of competition for people's attention.
No, he wasn't. But he was very competitive in that regard. It became quite compulsive. And there's people in the book, Graham Parker and Midge Ure, Tony Visconti, who all had their girlfriends, mercilessly hit upon by it.
Oh, that's the thing.
Come and gangle and interview.
Graham Parker's got a really attractive girlfriend and lined at Caesar. And
is really pissed off when he can't have her. I mean, really, quite seriously, it ruins his night. And, that he can't
have... Terrific new
it's like
book
JFK
about...
used to get a headache, didn't he?
There's a terrific new book about Paul McCartney just coming out, which makes the point that even the Beatles wouldn't leave their new girlfriends in a room with Paul McCartney. And it's the same with him, wasn't it?
They would come back
with their new girlfriends. They wouldn't dare leave them alone with
Phil. There's a great story about Bob Geldof being around at his house, and Philip, they're supposedly doing cocaine, but Philip gives them a line of smack so that Bob goes off to throw up in the toilet... And Philip tries to get... Yeah, of course, we've all done it.
We've all done it.
And he tries to get Paula Yates into bed as Geldof is shaking uncontrollably over the toilet bowl. He's trying to woo Paula Yates. So he was incorrigible. But I think there was a sort of slightly darker, compulsive side to that.
The hepatitis... You mentioned him getting hepatitis. Yeah. I mean, that's quite a significant thing because it reduces the liver's ability to resist what it's being bombarded with. Is that right?
That is right,
yes. It generally weakens your immune system. And at this stage, you just started taking ludicrous... The amount of booze is just phenomenal.
Well, the recommendation is to stop drinking when you get hepatitis, I think, forever. He went on to white wine, I think, for 6 months.
Yes, with soft drinks. Soft drinks, white wine.
And I think champagne was doctor's orders, as you said. And that was 6 months, and then he was back on everything, and even more so. So, hepatitis is quite serious.
Oh, we've gone the wrong way. Sorry, where are we? I put this picture in because this was in 1978. Was it the Greedy Bastards? This was a group he formed, a kind of pub rock band, really. With I'm trying to think if I can identify it. That's Chris Spedding, I think, second from the right. And
Chris Spedding.
That's Paul Steve Cook, and that's Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols.
Jimmy Bean down there.
Oh yeah,
Jimmy
that's right.
Bean
and Gary Moore. In fact, several members of Thin Lizzy.
So this is when he was straightening up a bit, wasn't he? He was seeking some better company.
this is him. Yes, social climbing.
let's straighten myself out. 2x Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
And
Jimmy Bean. Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting because he obviously made a fair amount of money. At one point he bought a house in, I think, the late 70s by the gates in Kew Gardens for £250,000, a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he bought a house for his mother, etc. But he never really made a fortune. I don't know whether that was they simply didn't sell that many or the way the business was structured in those days meant you simply couldn't make those kind of quantities of money. I don't know.
What they had was they had all their crew on a retainer 24/7 all year round. So with their management were constantly saying... you're not Queen. You're not selling at arenas in America. You're Hammersmith Apollo level. But as the managers pointed out, your guitar tech's your drug dealer. They were part of the system of that band was having these people on call 24/7 to just run out and do whatever they had to.
So that's why they just toured the whole time.
That's why they toured the whole time, and that became the lifestyle, really. And I think that goes right back to the show bands and the Black Eagles. He was doing that when he was 13 or 14 when he was at school. He'd be out two or three nights a week and maybe one weekend, going off to Connemara or whatever.
Yeah.
And coming back at 3 a.m. and then crawling into the Christian Brothers school. So I think he was absolutely, pickled in that lifestyle from a very early age of being a road band. And that's always seemed to be what mattered to him, I think, was how they did it every night, that live connection with his audience.
But also in the generation before the kind of video boom. I always thought there was a line that suddenly appeared about 1979. Before that would be, the Jam, the Stranglers, Elvis Costello, Stones, whoever. And after that was the Human League and Soft Cell. And before that, those people just were programmed to get up in the morning and go to work, weren't they? Paul Weller still is. He just gets up in the morning, gets up guitar, case, goes on play. And they can't really run their lives when they're not in that structure of touring. They sort of fall apart.
Exactly, and he couldn't. That's what happened in the end. Thin Lizzy broke up and he started a new band straight away because he had no structure, scratching
around at home.
As Bob Geldof said, he had to put on leather trousers to go to work, go to the shop around the corner. He didn't know how not
getting
to
out
be
of bed in the morning,
a rock star. Yeah.
Could not be filled with the lineup.
Yeah.
So where are we? Wrong way again. I love this picture.
I love this picture too.
Because you know, I think all women, you know, if they turn to the man they're about to marry in the church service and saw him A, perspiring heavily, B, clearly pissed, and C, laughing, sniggering about something, I think that would give you pause for thought and
turn
concern.
On your heel and go.
You could just cut and run.
Yeah. Your life.
Cut and run.
It does tell a
this is Caroline Crowther. Caroline Crowther's father, as you all know, is Leslie Crowther of Crackerjack fame.
Come on,
never
down,
off the cover of TV Times with Peter Glaze. And he had this brilliant moment. I remember reading an interview with him at the time when he said about Phil had asked for his daughter's hand in marriage. He said, "You've had every other bit of her. You might as well." But to tell us a bit about this, because you know, this is—I mean, there'd been a huge number of women. So, what was it about Caroline Crowther that made him decide to marry her and have children?
Well, they had children first, so that might have been something to do with it. Yeah,
you ought to write it.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, they had two children by this point. I think he genuinely loved her. You know, Caroline, who I spoke to for the book and who is now the estate, and is a very smart woman. And very clear-eyed about, I think, about what he was. You know, it was a genuine relationship for a long time, and I think he had that classic thing where, on the one hand, he was a mummy's boy, and he wanted to devote himself to one woman, and then when he was away from home, he was just incorrigible and couldn't help himself. Always, I think, seeking some kind of affirmation from the female race. So, yeah, I mean, she was very young. She was only about 20 when they got married, and she already had two kids, and it just tells a million words, that picture, doesn't it?
She writes, there's a very nice afterword in the book that she writes, and she says that in all the time that she knew him, was married to him, she was hardly ever alone with him. That he always had to have
always someone
mates
around.
There, members of the band.
There was one particular guy called Gus, who was just the general lackey driver. And she had t-shirts made called Where's Gus? Because literally every morning when Phil woke up, he would say, "Where's Gus?" And that, you know, that was how who would facilitate.
You can't build a home life on
that. Doesn't work, does it?
Somebody who goes, "Where's Gus?"
No, "Where's Gus?" "Where's, you know, where's the kitchen?" or something might work. Yeah. You know, "Where's Gus?"
Isn't that the case for so many performing rock stars that they can't operate for a split second during the day without an audience? They don't feel it's worth saying anything unless there's a large number of people listening. So it's a waste of time having a conversation with just one person.
And I think also that problem of perhaps being on your own, I think that's quite characteristic of a lot of rock stars as well. It's just that, how do you spend that downtime? And he never seemed to be comfortable on his own, ever. So, I mean, he had two kids and he had a wife, but he had a whole other entourage.
Everybody says he loved the kids and liked being with them, but was still away.
Yeah, see you. Yeah, you know, come back with lots of lovely presents. Yes. Great fun for a couple of days, and then he's off to Oslo or whatever for that all-important solo tour, you know. So, yeah, it's very hard. And
had Thin Lizzy split up? This is 1980.
They hadn't split up.
They're still going with it.
Yeah. This was after the stag do with, you know, Lemmy and whatever.
Christ. Lemmy organising his stag do.
I think he did, yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, Christ. So you finish up gaffer tape to a lamppost. Basically, in your underpants.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just dreadful.
In the rainbow,
Yeah. I put this, this is one of the several groups he formed when Thin Lizzy did split up. This is 1984, I think. And it starts to get a bit sad, the book, doesn't it?
I think so,
he obviously just can't operate without the group and without the attention, without that, as I said, that kind of framework in his life, and starts to form a series of decreasingly interesting bands.
Absolutely.
Like this one, Grand Slam.
Yeah, sort of third-rate Thin Lizzy, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
With these very young... The only people who would work with them, really, were these very young heavy metal guitar players who were felt quite privileged to be in his orbit.
Yes.
But everyone who had been with them for a while wouldn't play with them anymore. But I think it is exactly that. He just... The alternative was staying at home and addressing his problems, sorting himself out.
And, so did anybody try to sort him out? Did anybody get hold of him and say...
No.
You know, 12
didn't.
Steps or whatever? No.
No, I mean, I'm not sure that was part of the narrative at that time.
No, it wasn't.
So much.
Probably wasn't. It wasn't. I think that's fascinating. It's quite... At no point does anybody intervene and try and take him for a quiet walk around the block or suggest that he goes and dries out somewhere. They just kind of let him get on with all...
It's interesting that kind of background characters in your book... in Dublin are U2 who are kind of coming along, aren't they? And that really is a shift to a completely different
different way of looking at the world.
Entire minds, different mindset. Bonner was so scared that he wouldn't even go round to his house for dinner because he didn't know what would happen. Yeah, it's great. Because I better not.
That was the new
I might never arrive out.
Frightened.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got this very fervent sort of new rock, kind of rock and roll that's coming through.
Quite Puritan.
Quite really. Puritan, exactly. And as we said, you have to apologise for your rock and roll antics. Well, probably started around then, didn't it? In that Live Aid period.
Absolutely,
And he was a man
out of time. Interestingly, he wasn't invited to participate by his best friend, the man he'd given the heroin to when he was trying to cop on his girlfriend.
For some reason,
Bob couldn't find it in his heart to invite him.
I know. But also Midge Ure, of course, who was actually in Thin Lizzy.
Of course, in Thin Lizzy. And
Chris Morrison, who was...
he was very wounded by the fact that he wasn't invited.
I think it was a real stab in the heart, yeah, because... And everyone says, of course, you know, well, Lizzie would have been amazing at Live Aid. Can you imagine them reforming and playing Boys Are Back in Town? Who knows? That might just be a romantic idea of what it would have been like. He was quite far gone by that point, so I'm not sure.
He must have been, because I only met him once. Did you ever meet him and interview him?
No.
I met him once in 1982. I was on a private plane flying to Tyne Tees Television with a group called Musical Youth. Do anybody remember them? Who had a fantastic record called Pass the Duchy Pon the Left Hand Side.
Yep, yep.
And I was travelling up them to write a piece for Smash Hits, where David and I worked at the time. And I was sat next to Thin Lizzy. And Phil, it was 9:30 when the plane took off, and Phil ordered four of those miniatures of scotch and two little cans of Coke.
Yeah.
And I can remember him just slowly pouring them in, just drinking them one by one. Yeah. And thinking, this is unbelievable, really. And he was just so kind of bloated and sweaty and... It was just horrific.
It was a horrible decline. It was actually from someone who, as we said, you know, someone who was very driven and together and kind of ran the whole show, to someone who just couldn't get up in the morning and was living in absolute squalor, living with people he didn't really know. You know, there's a whole entourage of hangers-on by this point in his house who are just sleeping on the sofa. And
Do you think it's because, excuse me, that he got to a point in his career, they got big, but they never got really big.
No, they didn't, yeah.
And that kind of... It's difficult to live with that lack of momentum, isn't it?
I think so.
When you're back in the same place year in, year out.
Yeah, when you're back at Hammersmith Apollo two nights, three nights, Inverness Ice Rink, you know. America just didn't happen. It nearly happened, and it kept...
Why didn't it happen?
Because of, you know, Gonzalez, and because of Brian Robertson cutting his hand.
Famously, Tony Parsons was sent by the NME... to do Thin Lizzy in the States, and peeled off and did Bruce Springsteen instead, and they put him on the cover of the NME.
There was also the Springsteen thing, actually, because he was kind of regarded over there as a sub Springsteen.
Yes,
that's right.
Even though they both kind of came around at the same time, of course Springsteen made it big first over there, and I think a lot of the press coverage did focus on that, which didn't help. But yeah, I think you're right. It became a very, very tedious circle they were existing in, and then you get things like heroin and cocaine. It's such an old story, isn't it? Just fill that void.
This was no great shock or surprise to anybody. On the 11th of January 1986, when he would have been 36, and you know, it's a really drawn out process. I mean, he actually was in sort of coma for 11 days, is it, or something? Or wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Kind of unconscious for a while.
Yeah, he collapsed on Christmas Day, and then he died on the 4th of January, I think. Yeah, it was a very odd couple of weeks. He was kind of conscious for a while, and he seemed to be getting better. But effectively, his entire system had packed up. You know, all his organs had basically ceased to work. It was a terribly sad ending, really.
Yeah.
And there's no way of... I mean, you know, the rock and roll debauchery side of it is good fun, but there's no way of dressing up the fact that someone who's 36 and got a couple of kids and stuff. And I think has still a lot more to do. I do feel that he was someone who, if he'd taken a break, could have done something quite interesting. You know, I think his voice was very expressive, and if he maybe just toned it down a bit, there could have been a lot more music from
him. But he was just panicked by being left behind and just went out and formed ninth-rate versions of the
exactly.
groups that used to be
just
in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Panicked and terrified of stopping.
Yeah.
I think it was all it was. And how do I not be a rock star for a bit and see what...
There's a great bit you wrote in your intro. Where is it? You said, Philip rose and he fell, and somehow that rise and fall was simultaneous. Really good point. At times in this tale Linnet looks like someone who threw it all away. At other times, he looks like a man who spun gold from a fistful of thin air. And, of course, he was both and more all at once. It's a really good point. This is a panic throughout the whole thing, that he's got it and he's losing it all the time.
And it is weird that at that peak, the boys are back in town and jailbreak, it was already going wrong, even as it was peaking. It was quite extraordinary.
That's
thing.
Life.
That is life. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. But it's already over when you think it's going well.
Yeah, and he could not relax into it.
Yeah.
No. He could not enjoy it.
Don't think
it.
It's going to happen again. No. Particularly in pop music, it's not going to happen again. You know?
Yeah.
We're going to have time for some questions in a moment, but I've just got one more, actually, which is after writing the book, what did you feel his real contribution, his real achievement was? I mean, there's certainly an element that he'd broken the Irish tradition and allowed groups like the Boomtown Rats and U2 to kind of tunnel out after him.
Yeah, definitely.
But was that part of it? Was that part of what he achieved, do you think? Or
I think so. I mean, if you could say it was even more... you know, culturally wide than that for Ireland. I think, you know, in a sense, Ireland always had an inferiority complex. And culturally, you've got this guy whose sexuality is very, you know, in your face. And I'm not sure they had anyone like that before then. You know, Van Morrison, who he's not necessarily...
Oh, that was a terrible thought.
Cut from the same cloth in the leather.
I can't get it out of my head.
So, Van Morrison in your face.
I think he did sort of stand as a symbol of a new sort of confidence and masculinity for Ireland and a new sense of self-expression. Musically, I think, you know, he brought... we talk about poeticism and poetry, and I write in the book trying to distinguish between good lyrics and actual poetry. You know, they're very different things, but I do think he brought a real sense of poetry and atmosphere to rock music that a lot of other bands didn't do at that time.
Yeah.
And great, you know, Dancing in the Moonlight is a great pop song. They weren't just a rock band. I think he was a very gifted writer and a very gifted singer. But I think Ireland is probably where his legacy, you know, they've got a statue of him in Dublin, and he is an absolute icon.
Rock statues, never a good idea.
It's not one of the worst ones.
It's a pretty terrible
It's pretty
one.
Bad, but it's not Michael Jackson.
What does it look like? Describe the pose.
The pose
is... Is he machine-gunning an imaginary audience?
No, he's kind of holding his bass is sort of standing up by his side. He's got one of those sort of cowboy western ties that come down there. He's very tall. It's not great, I'll admit, but it's not the worst.
There.
It's not the worst I've seen, there.
You know Danny Baker's theory about why modern sculpture doesn't work of men? The trousers.
The trousers.
You can't do a sculpture of trousers. That's why the great sculptures are kind of people
marble.
In Roman kind of...
Yeah.
You know, turned off with a toga. So forth. Trousers, completely. No, leather trousers, particularly.
Imagine leather trousers are particularly tough to pull off in bronze. Yeah.
Well, on that thrilling fashion note, have we got any questions from the floor? Of a fashion nature, by all means. Anybody got any questions for go? Yes, you, sir.
Inevitable that he would have what? I I have all these kind of romantic fantasies of what he might have been doing, and I nearly wrote in the book, but I took it out. That, you know, I could see him with a sort of suede jacket and lots of bangles on, sitting in somewhere like this, actually, with an acoustic guitar and playing kind of jazzy, you know, deconstructed versions of Thin Lizzy hits in a sort of very cool way. I imagine he probably would have reformed Thin Lizzy and would be doing the circuit... playing the boys are back in town as we speak. I think, you know, there would still be a market for that.
It'd be a huge market.
There would be, yeah. I think there would be. And, you know, you can see the similar bands are still doing well. But I think that was... It says, you know, a lot of his friends said when Thin Lizzy ended, that was really the end of him. I think he would have probably reformed the band as quickly as he could have. And there would have been more of that kind of music.
Any more questions? Yes, over here, yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't. Well, I have spoken to Philomena before, but I didn't speak to her for the book. She's written her own book. I don't know if you are aware of that book called My Boy, which is a kind of memoir of her time. Without going into too much detail, there's a fair amount of animosity between some of the family still. So getting all of them on board was not going to be possible. And she has told her story, and as much as she wants to tell of it, I think. I mean, those early years are pretty murky, and as I say, there's still people involved who are alive, and I think you get a clear flavour in the book of kind of what it was like and what was going on at that time without maybe going into too much really personal detail. But she's an extraordinary woman. I mean, she has done so much for his legacy, I think. You know, the statue was her thing. And I think, you know, he's probably much better known now than he was when he died. He is now a kind of icon in America as well. So she's had a huge part to play in that. Yeah. What, Philomena? He did. I also think, I don't know if you know the song Wild One. Do you know that song? I think that's about her as well. I think that's about her leaving him, or him having to leave her when he was young and wanting her to come back. So she, I think she had a very mixed influence on his life. You know, she was in later life, she was incredibly supportive and they were very close. But I think that early wounding was quite profound.
Quite a lot of the time, he was brought up by his grandparents, wasn't he?
He was brought up by his grandparents, yeah, effectively. Yeah. Yeah, he was, from the age of seven till.
So how did she feel about that? She's writing a book called My Boy about the, you know, the son that she handed over to her.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question. I think there is a sense of her trying to justify that decision. Yeah. She had a very difficult early life. I mean, it was that whole Philomena film, and that whole, she managed to keep hold of Philip. It would have been very easy, I think, to have just let the Catholic Church whisk him off to Australia.
That's a good point.
I mean, it really would have been. She was pressurized into trying to do that. So she did, you know, she kept her contact with him and made sure he had a good upbringing in Ireland. So there's a lot for her, I think, to be applauded for.
A chance for one more? Yes. Yeah, at the back, yeah.
They were, but I mean, he was quite—he was kind of accepted by the punks, you know. He hung out with a lot.
Quite old school.
Yeah, that whole kind of Stiff Records thing. He was part of that crowd. I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of those bands survived punk, didn't they? I think he wanted to be. The problem he had in the later years was he wanted to be, you know, 77. He wanted to be punk. 78. He wanted to be new wave. 79. He wanted to be new romantic. You know, he was. He was constantly, at that point, chasing the tail of whatever trends were coming. Midge, I think, was a big part of getting him in the band, was a big part of saying, what's happening now? Oh, it's keyboardy stuff, so I'm going to get Midge in. And Yellow Pearl, which was you might remember as a theme tune to Top of the Pops. Yeah, which was a Midge song that he basically...
That was the record he was promoting when I met him on that plane.
Was it?
In 1982.
Which, you know, you heard Midge playing this thing and he basically said, I'm having that.
Yeah.
You know, so there was that sense of him kind of losing or second-guessing his own talent by that point and just trying to hang on to the coattails of whatever were happening. And he could never be punk because he just wasn't built that way, was he? A different generation, I think. But some of those songs, Waiting for an Alibi, and, you know, they're quite punky in their energy. But, I think the swift turnover of trends by the late 70s, I think, affected them quite badly, yeah.
Well, it is a... It's what we call a rollicking read. You were saying this earlier. If you handed a book to publishers, they nearly always describe it as rollicking.
Rollicking.
even if it's a sort of perfectly...
Jane Austen, rollicking.
Novel. Rollicking, Jane Austen, exactly. To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf, rollicking.
Rollicking.
And it is fantastic. It's a really, really good book. It's an incredibly vivid and supercharged story, and it's brilliantly told. And Graham will be signing copies of it outside right now. So please show your appreciation for the tremendous Graham Thompson. Thank you very much.
Graham Thompson.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back here with our other guest, David Hepworth, in about 10 or 15 minutes
after you've had
a
few drinks.
Get a drink, buy a book, have a free vegetable samosa.
Stretch your legs, have a samosa.
Terry has provided trays of samosas for everybody. Bless him.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.